Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Writer and photojournalist Denis Ellis-Béchar has reported from all around the world, India, Colombia, the Congo, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And along the way, as any foreign journalist does, he's spent quite a bit of time in the expatriate community. That experience provides the basis for his latest novel, Into the Sun, which examines the mindset of the expatriate community in Afghanistan, which he says is filled with war zone visionaries, cowboy aid workers, adrenaline junkies, and world savers. It's also a place where one can reinvent oneself and hide secrets from home. And this is at the heart of the novel, which surrounds the car bombing death of three American expats: Alexandra, a human rights lawyer for imprisoned Afghan women; Justin, a born-again Christian who's teaching at an Afghani school; and Clay, an ex-soldier working as a security contractor. Denis Ellis-Béchar is the author of four books in all. His first novel, Vandal Love, won the 2007 Commonwealth Writers' Prize. Cures for Hunger was a memoir about growing up with his father who robbed banks. And Of Bonomos and Men, A Journey into the Heart of the Congo, which won the Nautilus Book Award for Investigative Journalism. His work has appeared in the L.A. Times, Salon, Pacific Standard, and Foreign Policy. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Denis Béchar, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Your new novel, Into the Sun, sort of explores the whole expatriate world in a war zone. And in this case, Afghanistan, which you've spent a number of months over a few years between 2009 and 2014. What made you decide to explore the world of the expatriates? Because it's a whole mix of people, and in your novel, we get a sense of the scope of the mix of expatriates in a war zone like Afghanistan.
Well, I've spent a good deal of my life overseas, and I'd say the majority of the last 10 years have been overseas, and I've always been interested in the sorts of cultures that expatriates form in different countries. And when I first went to Afghanistan in 2009, I was fascinated by the sort of culture they had there. It was really unlike anything I'd ever seen. And it had a very strong influence on the country as a whole. In many countries, you'll see an expatriate culture that is pretty invisible to the larger culture. But in Kabul, the expatriate culture was in many ways an extension of the foreign governments that were involved in Afghanistan, either in the form of a very large media presence or a very large aid or development presence. And so I was fascinated by this, and I wanted to explore it and understand who these people were and what their relationship was to Afghanistan. And I should also add that my first impression of Kabul, first of all, it's a city that's 6,000 feet up in the mountains, surrounded by towering mountains, a rather cold city. My first impression was of a sort of Wild West boom town. And when the United States invaded in 2001, the population was maybe a little more than 500,000, and it's now between 4 and 6 million, depending on the estimates. It's a really large city. It's the fifth fastest growing city in the world. And it's grown so dramatically with all this foreign aid and the refugees coming back. But when I first went, I had this impression of a Wild West gold rush boom town. It was just drawing people from everywhere, and it certainly has drawn a lot of expats, and many of those are mercenaries, they're former soldiers, they're security contractors. A lot of them are people who are sort of, you use the Wild West analogy, more missionary types who want to come in and save Afghanistan, who want to do a variety of different projects. You're world savers, people who can make get-rich-quick types, who can make a profit off it. So it was a really rich, interesting scene. And a lot of the people who were in the expat communities were really there to build careers and reinvent themselves, and they were using Afghanistan as the opportunity to develop the sort of persona or reputation that they had always wanted. And so it was great material for storytelling.
Now, you mentioned Kabul growing to 4 to 6 million. Was that, I would assume that was even much larger than the city had been prior to all the conflicts, which,
oh yeah,
yeah, that sent refugees abroad.
Yeah, much larger. Yeah, it was. I mean, if you look at photos of the city, aerial photos of the city from before, it was a relatively small cluster of buildings around a river in the middle of a large plain that's essentially a valley. And if you look at photos of it now, the city just sprawls. It goes all the way up the mountainsides, all around it. It's a house upon house, homes crammed into every little space imaginable. So it's really grown a lot.
Now you mentioned, you said you wanted to capture this sort of boomtown feel from the fact that you have foreign governments, including the United States, dropping so much money into this country. Does that make this expatriate community a lot different than, say, others where you don't have, say, something like the United States sort of involved in a military operation like this?
Absolutely. It makes it very different. I think that you might have other expat cultures in countries where there has been conflict, where there's a lot of development work that will share certain traits. But when you have an active war zone and people who are coming to it, first of all, a lot of them are going to be risk takers. They're going to be people who want a certain level of adventure. And there are also people who, in a sense, like seeing themselves sort of on this global stage. Afghanistan has for many years was sort of often at the center of the news cycle. People were paying attention to it. And you could have people who would show up there who were often kind of referred to as war tourists, who didn't really have any experience as aid workers or journalists, and they wanted to become somebody who was an activist or an aid worker or a journalist. And so they would show up and start to reinvent themselves. But oftentimes it was, you know, an attraction to danger or a desire to sort of play a role of somebody who goes to that sort of place. And it was interesting watching social media, because you really see these people develop their personas on social media. You know, you can arrive in Afghanistan and you could go there right now, and then tomorrow you could be posting all over Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and you become a de facto correspondent. People start following you for information about that country. And it also allows you to sort of reinvent who you are, to show your friends this adventure. And then you can also use that as leverage to become a journalist or become somebody who has experience in those countries. So sort of being there becomes credentials in and of themselves.
And there's a couple of scenes early in the book that sort of point out this idea of the boomtown and also the reinvention. I think it goes when Justin first, one of the characters, Justin, who is, as you sort of mentioned, he's one of the persons out to save Afghanistan. And there's sort of a sizing up of him as he's walking through the airport, arriving and seeing people on the plane. There's sort of this immediate sizing up of who this person is and who this person is likely to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's imagining a future self. He's imagining the person people will perceive him to be. And he's trying to become that person before he's even arrived. You know, upon his arrival, he's trying to imagine the sort of respectable profile he'll have. What's also, I think, really interesting about Afghanistan, and this will tie back into Justin's character, is that America doesn't think of itself as a colonial nation. We don't think of ourselves in the same way that maybe Great Britain thought of itself during the colonial period. And yet other countries think of us that way.
Hmm.
And if you were to go to Kabul, the height of the civilian surge was when the United States was funding a large civilian presence to win the hearts and minds of Afghans. And civilians were, the book kind of addresses this, where civilians are almost, in a sense, they are part of the military effort in a way that we don't normally conceive of civilians as being. But if you were to look at Kabul, you'd see all these Westerners coming in, and they have their Afghan helpers or servants keeping them alive, basically. The Westerners are often closed up behind walls. They don't have much contact with the general population. They have these little fiefdoms that they run, and they need the Afghans for survival, and they fund a great deal of things in the lives of the Afghans. And what happens is you get a culture that's intermediary. You get a culture that's not really Afghan, but is somewhere, it's sort of been a fusion of that expat culture that relies on people and trains people to serve it. And when I first went to Afghanistan, I thought, well, in some ways this must have been what the British Raj looked like or any of these other overseas colonies. And this sort of neocolonialism or, you know, Western imperialism as it is perceived by people in these countries, it's perceived very much like a colonial project, and often called that. And so the character like Dustin, or these characters who arrive in Afghanistan, they want to play a role in nation building. They want to be saviors. They see themselves in a messianic way as those who are kind of carrying the light to another country and going to make that country more like America. And at the same time, what the book is looking at is the way that on the global stage, Americans present themselves as these saviors and these people who are, the global police who bring peace to the world. And yet back home, we're a mess. We have a lot of problems, and there's all the characters are actually fleeing something back home.
Right.
They're running away from trauma or violence to go overseas and reinvent themselves as somebody who is above all that.
It's interesting, I follow on that thought of Americans not seeing themselves as colonial. In a way, I think you nailed it when you said it's neocolonialism, because really for a lot of these people that go into, say, Afghanistan, it's not so much like the British setting up the Raj, which was, we're here to stay. It's more a situation of, I'm going to make a name for myself, I'm going to make some money, I'm going to exploit this situation. Sort of like that boomtown mentality you're talking about of prospecting, hitting a big score, and then moving on to the next town.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing with colonialism is it always was exploitative.
Sure.
I mean, there was. I think the governments would go in and say, "We're here to stay. We're going to colonize this country, and we're going to make it part of our trading empire." But the people who came would often say, well, I'm gonna build this, run this project, open this plantation, make all this money, then I'm gonna go home to England.
Right, or I'm a gentleman escaping, like some of your characters.
Yes, exactly. Or they're escaping.
Yeah.
And so it's not the exact same dynamic, but it's still very much in that vein of here's a presence that there's that duality in the narrative. You have a narrative saying we're here to spread democracy and save Afghanistan. And what we're really doing is we're really there for our national interests, or we're really there to make money, to exploit or to self-promote. And so the book is trying to look at the conflicts even within the narratives of the people who are there.
Now, there's another scene at the very beginning of Into the Sun, which sort of points out that boomtown mentality. It's very early in the book, Machiko, who we don't really know who she is at the very beginning of the book. She's some sort of journalist, we think, but they're at a party at a security contractor. They're having a lovely evening, and then all of a sudden there is attack by a Taliban force. And, they all herd into his safe room, which is this, sounds from your writing like a really well-appointed safe room, and they've got TV monitors. They're watching everything go out, and it's almost like it's a selling opportunity to sell somebody a safe room.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a slightly comical scene in the sense that some insurgents attack a party, and the guy who's throwing the party is he sells safe rooms, and so he has the nicest safe room probably in all of Kabul. And everybody gets to go in there and admire his safe room. So it definitely looks like a selling opportunity, and people even joke about that during the attack. And they're essentially watching this attack on themselves on a television. And so, in a sense, even though they're in Afghanistan, they're still watching the violence on TV. They're not in the West. They're not in America. They're still much more in danger. And yet, there's a bit of a playfulness to it in the sense that even though they're under attack, they're still basically a bunch of Americans watching terrorism on TV.
Yeah. There was also your description of how Machiko reacts to this first explosion. It's very visceral, and I was wondering if maybe you have experienced something like that before yourself. It said, when the first bomb explosion occurs, she goes, "My breath was knocked out of me, my ears ached as if someone had simultaneously shoved me and slapping me, and also the space my body occupied contracted." That was a really interesting description. In your time in Afghanistan, did you experience a situation where there was an explosion close to you and you sort of had this sort of reaction yourself?
Not precisely like that one. No, that was. I guess I would say that having spent a good deal of time there, I've been around a number of people who have maybe experienced that more explosions more like that, and certainly talked about it, read about it, and done my research as a writer. I have been pretty close to a rocket strike, and I am aware of, and I've been in relatively close proximity to, say, for example, a car bomb going off, and I'm aware of how much that moves the air and how much just how concussive those sorts of explosions are. And so that scene was built from a small amount of experience, personal experience, and also research and talking to people who had been closer to explosions.
My guest today is Denis Ellis-Béchard. His new novel is titled Into the Sun. Béchard is a writer who's written both nonfiction, memoir, as well as novels. This is a novel set in post 9/11 Kabul, titled Into the Sun. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Now, your work in Afghanistan was a photojournalist, and it's really interesting work. You've watched how Kabul has become a real surveillance capital, as well as taking photos. How has your photojournalism sort of focused the effort into this novel? What did you learn about Kabul that you could put in the novel from your work as a photojournalist?
Well, I guess I often use the journalism as a way to get into situations I wouldn't normally be able to get into. I'm foremost a writer of fiction. That's how I started out, with being a novelist. And I got into journalism because I had a lot of convictions that things needed to be talked about in different ways, and that we weren't getting all the stories we should be getting. And I couldn't put that into fiction. And so I worked as a journalist. I also worked as a print journalist. My third book is a book of journalism, and I do write a good deal of articles. And the photojournalism, sometimes it's just pure photojournalism, sometimes it's a mix of photojournalism and articles. But what I've found is that as a novelist, I think my fiction is better because I do journalism, and I meet more people, and I spend a lot of time having to understand them, to develop relationships with them, to get good photos or to get good stories. And so I think that it opens a lot of doors. It allows me to see things I would never have otherwise seen, and to understand parts of the culture that I would never have otherwise understood. And so, above all, I think that, to get a good photo of somebody, you have to talk to them a bit, get comfortable with them, build a friendship to some degree. And, that's often the case, at least for me, in my experience. And I think that the understanding that arises from that has allowed me to write fiction that is maybe a little more sensitive to the place and the people.
Now, if you consider yourself a fiction writer first, when you're doing journalism, are you thinking, okay, will this be a novel sometime down the road? Or does a sort of a culmination of experiences in a place say, okay, this can be a novel, maybe at a later time?
I think that, for example, when I first went to Afghanistan in 2009, I remember seeing the sort of boomtown thing that we discussed and saying to myself, this has to be a novel. I need to write something about this crazy expat scene. And that was something I was always working on. So I was working on that novel, and during that period, I did a lot of other projects. Between 2009 and 2014, I worked on a lot of other projects, some that came to fruition and some that did not, in journalism. And sometimes, I really have no idea where it's going to lead, but it's rounding up my understanding. And so I might go do a photo essay. I did a photo essay where I embedded with the Afghan military and did a portrait series on Afghan soldiers. I don't really know where that's going to take me or how it's going to change my perception. But it, above all, it deepens my understanding of the national culture. I meet a lot of people that I just would not otherwise meet. And so I think that feeds into the novel in the sense that it allows me to write with a little bit more authority and a certain confidence that I have a sense, a better sense that what I'm saying is true in certain areas. But I often don't know. You know, I'll go into something and work on it, and sometimes something will spark an idea. Other times it won't. It's hard to say.
At the heart of your novel, Into the Sun, there's a statement, I believe it's from Michiko, I believe it, or one of the characters pretty early in, which says, from the expatriate's view, there's very rarely a random attack. When a random attack occurs, the expats sort of try to figure out why that attack occurred. And the central event of the novel is this triangle between two old friends from Louisiana, Clay and Justin, and a woman, Alexandra, who are in a car together, and there's a bomb that goes off. And so that's really the central story of the novel. Is that true, that when there are no random events in the expatriate community?
Well, it depends on the person. I mean, yeah. Some people are very pragmatic, and they'll say, oh, that's just random. And other people really like to have a story for everything and like to feel that there's a reason for it. And, you know, the way I describe that in the book is that it's hard to walk into the street if you think that a lot of things are random.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're making it, but if each time an expat gets killed, if you're convinced that they messed around with something they shouldn't have messed around, or they were involved with something that was questionable, then it's a little easier to say, hey, well, I'm innocent. I haven't been doing any of these things. Therefore, I will not be targeted. So I would hear a lot of conspiracy theories in Afghanistan. You know, I would have a conversation about someone who was killed, and one person would say, oh, it's just they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then another person who was in the room would whisper to me a moment later, no, you know, that person was definitely investigating so-and-so, and that person wanted to silence them. The book kind of plays that idea of how we create stories to give ourselves, to make ourselves feel safe or important. You know, the book's very much about the way people try to make stories to give meaning to their lives, or to give themselves authority, or to make themselves feel safe. And the central narrative of the book is this car bomb, like you mentioned. And Michiko, the journalist who's investigating it, trying to understand why these three people were targeted, whether they were important in some way, because they were actually very insignificant people in the grand scheme of what was happening in Afghanistan, and it didn't make sense for them to be targeted. And the story unwinds these characters' lives and shows who they were and how they ended up in Afghanistan, and raises the question that of, in a sense, how even the most insignificant people who come to Afghanistan have an outsized impact on the culture. They have a large impact on it, and can draw violence towards themselves.
In the case of Justin, he's there as an educator. He wants to help save Afghanistan. Clay is he's a security man. And growing up, Justin and Clay knew each other in Louisiana, and there was always an air of mystery about him. But he was always sort of well-equipped to take care of himself.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the story takes place in the United States.
Yes, it does.
That it's sort of about this, what's really a class conflict. You have an upper-middle-class kid who's very well-protected, who's Justin, and a very poor kid from rural Maine who moves to Louisiana and has a lot of family problems, who is Clay, and their friends, and the conflict between them in their youth, and they're both high school students, is very much around the privileges that one has and the assumptions that Justin can make because he's so well off and so comfortable in the world, and how much Clay has to struggle to invent himself to fit into that society,
mm-hmm.
which leads up to an act of violence. I don't want to spoil the story, yeah. people, but there's an act of violence between the two and their kids, and they find themselves again in Afghanistan, and the conflict and the hatred that was between them in the United States remains in Afghanistan, and ultimately leads to more violence there.
Yeah. The name of the book is Into the Sun. My guest today is Denis Bechar. This is his second novel. He's also written a work of nonfiction of Bonobos and Men, A Journey to the Heart of the Congo, investigative journalism looking at the Congo and also the fight to save bonobos. How did you get, was this, did that story come out of your photojournalism?
No, that story was, I had been working on a memoir for 17 years, and the memoir was about my father, who was actually a bank robber.
That was another book.
Yeah, people, that one's called Cures for Hunger. People always have a hard time believing that, but no, my father, according to him, robbed approximately 50 banks. He worked, so he was a criminal for a good part of his life. And I wrote a book about what it was like to grow up with somebody who was a criminal. And by the time I finished that, I was sort of felt like I'd spent 17 years navel-gazing. And I wanted to write something that was, you know, I was concerned about nature conservation. I was concerned about the environment. I feel like we're losing a lot of the great natural resources in the world. The forests are disappearing quite quickly. A lot of species are going extinct. And so I felt that a lot of the writing on it is ultimately depressive. It doesn't offer any solutions. You read about environmental problems and you put the book down and you go, oh, well, we're doomed. There's nothing we can do. And so I wanted to write a book that offered some solutions. And I looked for a group that was doing something innovative. And I found a group that was very innovative working in the Congo. And I spent some time following them around in the Congo and wrote the book about them.
Yeah, but it's another dangerous location. Was it dangerous where you were following the bonobo research?
No, not. Depends what your definition of dangerous is. it felt less dangerous than Afghanistan. It did not feel very dangerous to me in general. I'd spent time in other parts of Congo for other journalistic projects, and that sometimes felt more dangerous. But I always felt more or less, in general, I felt pretty safe in the Congo compared to Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you have a very, I mean, you the memoir, your first novel, and now you've come back to novel writing. Do you plan on sort of switching back and forth between nonfiction and fiction, or are you your eyes on fiction at this point?
I primarily see myself as a fiction writer. I do long form journalism, so I have articles that I'm working on. I'm very sure that I will write more books of nonfiction as well. I guess I would probably say that I foresee the ratio being 2-to-1 or 3-to-1. So 2 or 3 books of fiction to 1 book of nonfiction. That's my shooting from the hip estimate.
Now, are you working on another novel at this point?
I am. I'm actually finishing up another novel at the moment.
Is it some way based on your travels, or is it more of a domestic story?
This is more of a domestic story. It's more, I don't want to say too much about it, but it's more about racial violence in the United States. And I grew up mostly in Virginia and saw a lot of racism and a lot of violence, too, as a kid. And it's about sort of inspired by that, I would say.
Denny Ellis-Béchard's new book is titled Into the Sun, which set in the expatriate community of Kabul about 10 years after 9/11. Denny, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Writer, journalist, and photojournalist Denny Ellis-Béchard speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new novel, Into the Sun, is published by Milkweed Editions. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.